Four bodhisattva vows. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Desires are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharmas are boundless. I vow to master them. Buddha's way is incomparable. I vow to attain it. Nice to be back on a Wednesday night. Thanks for joining me tonight. All of nature embraces me with the cicada's song. So last month we did this, what we call the sutra study, platform sutra. And Huning had an awakening when he heard the Diamond Sutra. I'm only going to read to you one line from Diamond Sutra. And this is the section where Subhuti, Buddha's disciple, asks him, how should we practice? How should we control our thoughts? And in this answer, the Buddha says, Subhuti, those who would now set forth on the bodhisattva path should think this thought. However many beings there are in whatever realms of being might exist, whether they are born from an egg or born from a womb, born from the water or born from the air, whether they have form or no form, whether they are able to perceive or not perceive, or neither perceive nor not perceive, in whatever conceivable realm of being one might conceive of beings, in the realm of unconditioned nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. So then he continues and he says, and why not? To whom the conception of a being occurs cannot be called a bodhisattva. And why is that? Subhuti, no one can be called a bodhisattva who conceives of a being, a life, or a soul. So this one particular sentence, in the realm of unconditional nirvana, I shall liberate them all. And though I thus liberate countless beings, not a single being is liberated. Today, it's very fashionable to talk about non-duality. This is Buddha's prescription. Now, he's often referred to as the doctor, for you to understand non-duality in this very sense. Now, this particular translation, this is from Red Pine, of course, who's my favorite, says something in a way that I've never heard it said before. In other translations, it doesn't say in the realm of unconditioned nirvana. That's a really important element of this particular sentence. When we do the four bodhisattva vows and we say we save all sentient beings, this is a reflection of what Buddha just said. For years, I've been looking at different translations of sutras. And of course, it's all my mind. In terms of what I hear or what I see or what I appreciate or what I don't understand or what I do understand. And it's always changing. One of the things that happens with language, it's like a pot of soup that you're trying to replicate that comes from another part of the world where the ingredients are different, even though it might still be squash and beans, but the squash and beans have a different flavor. The herbs are different. For the most part, when something becomes popular, when something becomes in fashion, it loses something. The depth of what that experience was initially is lost. For example, when mindfulness became fashionable, it was plucked out of the soup. You couldn't get the whole flavor once you are living on that level of fashion, because it's on the surface, right? It's not the depth of the experience. It's not really tasting the soup. The same thing is true about other things like that. So there's a lot of chatter around non-duality. If you go on the web and punch in non-duality, boy, you're going to get a lot. Again, it's taking something out of the soup. You can't really understand it from the point of view of an intellectualization of what this is. We think we know what non-duality is. It's the opposite of duality. No, it's not. It contains duality. In the Platform Sutra, Yuning says, one mind. The mind contains everything. Emptiness is empty of preconceived ideas of what this is. It's not empty because it contains the whole universe. Non-duality is it all. But it's the experience of being part of it all, as opposed to feeling separate, isolated, sinner, where this is waking up to here, now, everywhere, just as it is, not some conceptual understanding that you've created. So getting back to making the soup, things become fashionable for a reason, because people are striving, looking, grasping for some answer to why things are the way they are for them. So there's always somebody willing to give you an answer. Zen doesn't give you any answers. Zen just points back to your own mind. The beauty of that is when you stop identifying with I, me, and mine, or as Buddha just said, a body, being, the soul. Because as soon as you add your thought on top of what's there in front of you, you're already not seeing it the way it is. So when mindfulness becomes a thought instead of a practice, it's not real anymore. It's a delusion.
In Christianity, there's the notion that you have faith, you repent for those sins, and in the exchange, you get everlasting life with the Father. Mm-hmm. In Zen, I kind of feel like it's saying you can have total freedom, or you can have no freedom at all. Or you can have freedom, or not. It's one of those things where in the other religions, there's a transaction. And this one is saying there's nothing to transact.
Freedom, if you're here, you're after it. If you're sitting here, you're here for a reason. And it's not to continue doing things the way you've been doing them. But as we practice and we get to know ourselves and we're waking up to what this experience is, including all our karma, our history, our attitudes, our fears, our anxieties, all of it, you know, we're getting to understand what we can rely on and what we can't. Eventually, or suddenly, there it is. We see it. And when we see it in everyone and everything. And nothing is different. And everything is different. It's referred to sometimes as suchness. Experience of just this. There isn't any other answer to this experience of life's deluded suffering that we keep creating over and over again, except to wake up to it. So we don't keep falling for it and, you know, just getting stuck over and over and over again. And every time we're stuck, it's okay, because that's the fertilizer for getting us to blossom. So, you know, we don't get caught up in right and wrong, left and right. What works? That's all I'm interested in. But that's not an idea. What you put in the soup is not an idea. It's a spice that you chose on purpose. So it tastes a certain way. It's not, you know, some fantasy. So chop wood, carry water, chop vegetables, cook them up, whatever it is. It's not so complicated. Just taking care of ourselves, really. And in the process, taking care of everybody else. Saving all sentient beings. In that suchness, there is no separation. Mind is great, capable of everything. It's not lacking in anything.
I actually just read a study like a week ago that was talking about mindfulness as a practice, and it said that people who practice it without the original Buddhist teachings are doing themselves a disservice. So it's kind of fitting that you bring that up tonight, because there are literally scientific studies out there happening right now that show that mindfulness by itself isn't enough for people to really grasp. You know, it's a good starting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like watching the breath. I mean, you know, physically, that's a great thing to do. It's a good way to get started on your practice. But the practice is much more than that.
Yeah, they described it in the article as like, it's like lucid dreaming. You're not awake yet, but it's a good starting point.
But you know, you have to know the difference between dreaming and not dreaming. As long as you know the difference, then you can dream all you want. That's freedom, you see. Because you still dream.
Yeah. But the idea of mindfulness untethered from just on its own, is it because people need some kind of ceremonial aspect in the moment of actual quiet contemplation tied with it? Is that the reason why mindfulness separated, you were saying?
No, it's because of our culture, because we do that with everything. There's all these ways. Appropriation, is that the word?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That we do that, right? And with all kinds of things. Labels, you know, that's what one of the things we talk about a lot is, don't get stuck with names, you know, words. You know, Zen is before thought.
Mm-hmm.
By the time mindfulness becomes a fashion, what I call a fashion, or popular, it's in the realm of intellect and words. And as soon as you hear it, you think you know what it is. Oh, yeah, mindfulness. I know that. Yeah. Path can be long and long or short. It's up to you. It can be lifetimes and lifetimes before you get it or not. I mean, it's up to you. But, you know, as a teacher, as someone who's trying to help people wake up, you have to pay attention to these things. You know, it's kind of like you have to adjust your teaching to what the circumstances and the people you're with. You can't just kind of put it out there, you know, in a sort of nondescript way. It has to be connectable. It has to be something that you can connect to and have a relationship to and get a sense of self within it. It's not like having to go somewhere to get the thing. It's about understanding yourself. A real teacher just points to your own mind, to you. Not, they don't try to give you something, you know, or sell you something. One of the reasons I brought up the whole thing about ancestors, 1,000 years, is so people don't think they're learning something brand new that some 20th century philosopher invented. No, I don't think so. There's a reason it's 1,000 years old, man. It works. It's, you know, fashions come and go.
That's what that article kind of said too. Like, we've seen it happen with other Eastern things like yoga.
Sure.
How it, you know, became westernized and then capitalized on, and now they sell it to you in a hot yoga class for $100 a pop or whatever. And that's what they're saying is happening with mindfulness. Now it's apps that you can download and you pay for it when you don't need
it. It's not that it can't, there isn't some benefit. I get it.
Right, but that was the idea behind it.
So yeah.
It's been westernized and therefore diluted because it's lost.
Yeah, I think it's really important to whatever the tradition is to have respect for it. I have a lot of respect for yoga. I'm talking about the soup. You know, even just smelling the soup. That smells good. That's not quite a good enough. You got to taste it. You know, drink the tea, in other words. You know, things that are on the surface. They're just on the surface. They don't have any roots. So, you know, they get washed away eventually. Already you see, already you hear. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.